This afternoon, I give my last talk in the series of five talks that I've been giving. And as we had decided, I'm going to speak this afternoon on caste and politics. I gave you a general and somewhat rambling discussion of some of the principal features of the caste system. Today, I pick out a particular aspect of that system in its relationship to the political order in India. Now, I would like to begin by saying that this is a large and somewhat untidy subject, and that there are several approaches to this problem. I would like to make a distinction at the outset between two possible approaches to the problem. Not that they cannot be used in combination, but nevertheless, one must keep in mind the distinction between these approaches or these different kinds of interests in the problem of caste and politics. The first approach is what may be called descriptive and analytical. That is, you study the relationship between caste and politics in order to analyze the mechanisms and the processes that are involved in that relationship. But you can also have an approach to the problem which is prescriptive and policy-oriented. I don't intend to say that the two should be kept strictly apart in all cases, but my own approach in today's exposition will be on the whole descriptive and analytical rather than prescriptive or policy-oriented. The reason for this is fairly obvious. It's not that I don't believe that there is nothing to be gained by having a prescriptive or policy-oriented approach to the relationship between caste and politics, but the issues are indeed extremely complex, and I think that it takes a certain amount of time to understand what those issues are. And no matter what kind of policy recommendation that one might care to offer, the supposed benefits will always be associated with certain costs. Not only is it difficult to make a careful calculation of the costs and benefits of no matter what policy prescription one makes, but in the end, the very nature of these costs and benefits is such that one has ultimately got to exercise some kind of judgment in deciding that this is what one opts for. I'm not saying that there is no scope for rational discussion as a basis for arriving at this judgment, but that's not the kind of exercise that one can engage in an abstract sort of way. One has a specific problem, then one examines the various aspects of that problem, one considers various possible policy recommendations, takes into account the possible benefits and the possible costs, neither of which can be calculated with exact precision, and then one arrives at a certain judgment and decides to go ahead. Now, that's not the kind of thing which we can really expect to do in a thorough way here, which does not mean that I am trying to evade all discussions regarding the prescriptive aspects of this problem. I'm sure that several of you will have questions about that, and I'll be perfectly happy to consider such questions. In this context, there's one specific thing that I would like to say, and I would like to remind you of, that when we are considering caste and politics in India over the last 40 years, the question of reservation or positive discrimination looms very large before our eyes. And this is particularly the case with those of us who are involved in the affairs of government, either as policy advisors or as civil servants. But one must remember that however large this particular issue might loom, it is nevertheless only one aspect of a much larger problem of the involvement of caste in politics. And it is really this larger problem that I am going to discuss today, not the more specific problem of what is called positive discrimination or reservations based on caste and community, which has a certain history of its own and which has implications which certainly need to be considered in detail. And again on this, I'll be perfectly happy to respond to questions or make my own observations on this, because as I said to some of you in private, this is a problem with which I have grappled for at least the last 10 years or so. So I'm not trying to evade answering questions relating to this specific problem, but I do want to emphasize this point, that the politics of reservation or the politics of the backward classes is one aspect of a much larger problem of the relationship between caste and politics. And I would like to set the sights clear in regard to this larger problem of the relation between caste and politics. And then we might take up in the question hour the more specific question of positive discrimination or caste quotas in education and employment. Let me then turn back to the more general analytical as against prescriptive approach towards the study of the relationship between caste and politics. I would say that this is a relatively new subject. This is a relatively new subject, although a large body of literature has already grown in regard to this subject. This is a post-independent subject as far as India is concerned. There's very little really serious discussion of this problem in the pre-independence period. As far as the descriptive and the analytical literature on this subject is concerned, it has grown really in course of the last 30 to 35 years. And various disciplines have in fact contributed. This is one of the most exciting areas in the social sciences, precisely for the reason that various disciplines have come together to study this subject. It has not been a monopoly of one specific discipline. If one were to ask me to single out an area of research which has really provided fruitful results from interdisciplinary collaboration, I would say this is one particular area in which there's been a lot of interdisciplinary collaboration and a lot of very fruitful understanding has resulted from this interdisciplinary collaboration in this area of the relationship between caste and politics. First of all, there are the social anthropologists and the sociologists, the tribe to which I belong, who became interested in this really in the post-independence period. Although sociologists and social anthropologists in India had studied caste before independence, they became interested in caste and politics only in the post-independence period as a serious subject for systematic investigation. And the way in which this came about is basically in the following way. Social anthropologists began to go out into the rural areas to do field studies, of emphasis from the book view to the field view of caste, not the Varna system as an ideal order of society, but how actually caste functioned at the level of village life or at the level of rural life. And when they began to examine this, they found that the manner in which the system functioned is in many ways rather different from the manner in which it was supposed to function. Then that they realized that it's jati which is the living reality. And they also found that this linear order of ranking which we assume when we focus attention on the Varna system, it doesn't really operate when we look at the jatis as the living units in an ongoing social system. Because there are dominant castes which belong neither to the Brahman nor to the Kshatriya Varna, but which are nevertheless extremely effective and extremely powerful in village politics. So in a sense, the work which tried to shift attention from the book view to the field view of caste also came up almost automatically with the notion of the dominant caste, which led to a considerable modification of our conception of caste and caste ranking. So, a fair number of social anthropologists, particularly fieldwork-oriented social anthropologists, were doing this kind of thing, starting from the 50s itself. And I think the first major work on this came to be published in the 50s. Srinivas's paper on the dominant caste and a set of village studies, edited by McKim Marriott, published in 1955, in which Srinivas contributed a piece on a village in Karnataka, what was then the old Mysore state. Kathleen Goff contributed a piece on Tanjore, and so on and so forth. And then by the 60s, the anthropologists had really established the credentials for studying politics in this way and the relationship between caste and politics. Now, in the meantime, political scientists, whose field of inquiry traditionally had been quite different from the field of inquiry of social anthropologists and sociologists, began to shift their attention a little away from the Swiss Constitution and the bicameral legislature, the hardy perennials of the textbooks of political science, and tried to find out how is the party system actually working in this country? How does the party system work in reality? And when they began to ask questions of this kind, they felt that it was not enough to look at what was happening in New Delhi. It was not enough to look at what was happening even in the state capitals. They needed to go down to the district level. And then they found, of course, that the functioning of the party system or the functioning of the electoral process could not be understood independently of the social context within which the electoral process was functioning, within which the party system was functioning, within which political networks were becoming activized. So that they also came to acquire an interest in the relationship between caste and politics and in the operation of caste in the political system. And one of the first fruits of this collaboration was in fact a book. And I would like to refer you to this book. This book was published sometime in the 60s. I've forgotten the exact date. Book edited by Rajini Kothari. Some of you, I'm sure, will have heard the name of Rajini Kothari. He's a very innovative political scientist. Not always reliable on every subject, but certainly a very innovative person. And I remember Rajini in those days, he was one of the very few political scientists in the country who welcomed the collaboration of sociologists and social anthropologists, and we in fact worked together on this book, which he edited, and this is called Caste in Indian Politics. Caste in Indian Politics. And it consists of a set of essays mainly by political scientists, but there's also one by myself, on the relationship between caste and politics in the different regions of the country. I have a piece called Caste and Politics in Tamil Nadu. Kothari himself has a piece on caste and politics in Gujarat. Then somebody has a piece on caste and politics in Maharashtra, and so on and so forth. So it's a very convenient book to dip into in order to get some idea of the relationship between caste and politics. Now, before I really enter into my own argument about caste and politics, there are just a couple of other general observations that I would like to make. And I wouldn't like you to forget altogether the observations that I made in my first two lectures about the general problems of comparative sociology. I think that our understanding of what is happening in India must certainly depend on the facts on the ground, but it is also illuminated sometimes by making comparisons with what is happening elsewhere, with other kinds of situations and systems. Yesterday I told you that when we think of caste, we can think of it in two different ways. We can think of caste as varna, we can think of caste as jati. We can think of caste as an ideal model, a hierarchical model of a society in which there are not only facts on the ground, but which has a hierarchical design itself. As against that, I said we can look at castes as jatis, which are the real interacting units in local communities. And I said that our understanding of caste as varna, as a society which is hierarchical both in fact and in theory, is illuminated to some extent by a comparison with the European estate system or with similar systems in other pre-industrial societies. I'm now going to say that our understanding of caste as jati, and particularly the role of jatis in the political process, is enormously illuminated by a look
at the operation of ethnic group politics in the United States. United States is the best example, but one can think of other examples as well. And several of us who contributed to this book, Caste in Indian Politics, quite unself-consciously, several of us, without consulting each other, in our papers, in fact, drew attention to the fact that many of the things that are happening in the political process in India today, the involvement of caste in the mobilization of political support, is in some ways strikingly similar to what was happening in the United States in the 1930s and 1940s, the involvement of ethnic identity in the mobilization of political support, particularly in the case of urban politics in the United States. New groups of immigrants coming in, being absorbed into the larger political and social system, and becoming a part of a kind of political order in which politicians played an important part in absorbing them into the political system. Yes, to some extent it is relevant, even in the political system of the United States today. Since you've raised that question, let me make a couple of further observations on this. You see, in the United States itself, of course, they have a theory that America is a melting pot of races and cultures. All kinds of people come in and they get into the melting pot and they come out completely homogenized. Now, this, in fact, has proved to be not wholly correct. It was argued, in the 50s, it was being argued that this ethnic group politics, was in fact a feature of the first phase of immigration. Now, this was the way in which the immigrants became absorbed into American society. The second, the third generation of ethnics would become homogenized in American culture, and you would no longer have the kind of ethnic group politics that you had in the 20s, 30s and 40s. This argument was being put forward towards the end of the 40s and the 50s. A major study made by Nathan Glazer and Daniel Moynihan. Moynihan, incidentally, was the U.S. ambassador to India, and Nathan Glazer is another Harvard sociologist who is married to an Indian, incidentally. Now, these two, Nathan Glazer is an American Jew, and Daniel Moynihan is an Irish-American, and they wrote a book called Beyond the Melting Pot, in which they showed conclusively that the melting pot does not by any means completely homogenize the distinctions between ethnic groups in the United States. These ethnic identities still remain important, and they are still an important factor in urban politics in New York City. This was a case study of urban politics and ethnic politics in New York City. Of course, there are lots of variations in all of this in different parts of the United States. There are certain parts of the United States where ethnic identities are particularly important in politics today. And in fact, it's not simply that ethnic identities continue to be important in American politics today, certainly in some parts of the United States, but the whole issue of affirmative action has some striking parallels to our problem of reservation on the basis of caste. But I will not continue with this any further. One point I want to make is that, and this comes up when one talks about the United States, it comes up even more sharply when one talks about India, that although one can speak in a general way of the relationship between caste and politics in India, I think that one will be able to form a really comprehensive picture only on the basis of detailed examination of each particular region. I think regional patterns are very variable in India. Regional patterns are extremely different in India from one part of the country to another. If you take a state like West Bengal, caste does not operate manifestly in the political process, at least in any conspicuous degree. So that's one extreme. If you look at West Bengal politics, I think class is manifestly much more important in the political process, certainly in the countryside, in the rural areas, kinds of cleavages between landowners, tenants, sharecroppers, landless laborers, these are the distinctions that figure much more prominently in the political process, whereas the distinctions of caste do not figure very conspicuously in the political process. If, on the other hand, you take a state like Gujarat, caste obviously plays an extremely important part in the political process, and there are other states as well in which Tamil Nadu today, caste is extremely important in the political process. Now, I just want to make one point which used to be made quite frequently in the 60s and 70s by the economists. And I remember one of our most distinguished economists, Professor K. N. Raj, used to make this point very sharply, but many others used to make the same point. And they would say that yes, there is an involvement of caste in politics, but you find it more conspicuous in some states, in some regions. There are other states and other regions where caste has ceased to play the same part in the political process. And from this they would infer that this is a matter of development. That is, you move from a level of politics which is relatively backward and where caste is involved in the political process, to a more advanced level of politics where caste drops out of the political process and is replaced by other social cleavages and other social issues. I personally believe, and this similar kind of argument had been made in the United States, by the way, earlier. I find this argument unconvincing. It's simple-minded. It's far too simple. It's not how things are. Maybe in another 200 years, caste will drop out of politics. But at least as far as the foreseeable future is concerned, this kind of developmental view of politics, that you have a certain backward style of politics, and it is in that phase that caste plays a conspicuous part, and then politics develops to a more advanced level, and then caste drops out and something else comes in its place. I find that this is too simple-minded. And the best example of that, best confirmation of my argument, is in fact provided by Kerala itself. Because although it is true that there are some states, like West Bengal, where class politics is very conspicuous and caste politics is inconspicuous, and there are other states where caste politics is very conspicuous and class politics is less conspicuous, there are some states like Kerala where both caste politics and class politics have coexisted for at least the last 40 years. In America, there are aggressive agricultural workers unions, trade unions, and so on and so forth, supporting left parties. At the same time, Nair Service Society, SNDP, various kinds of caste-based organizations also coexist. Now, therefore, it's an important part of the larger analysis of the political process to see how all this intermeshes. But that, of course, is not something that I'm going to do here. Because when I talk about the role of caste in the political process, I do not by any means intend to say that caste and caste alone is the decisive factor in the political process. There are many other important factors. It just so happens that I'm not going to talk about those other important factors in my presentation today. Okay. Now, having made those quite general observations, let me enter into a specific analytical point. That is, how does one provide some order, some system into the investigation of a phenomenon which by its nature is extremely untidy? Not only enormous regional variations, but within each region you have a great many different factors which are all operating at the same time. I think that the first thing that needs to be clarified is that we are dealing with units at different levels. We are dealing with units at different levels. So let me identify the units and the levels with which we are dealing. Now, I said yesterday that there is a distinction between varna and jati, and there is a somewhat different distinction
between caste, subcaste and sub-subcaste. Okay? I began by saying that when we are considering the involvement of caste in politics, Varna is not terribly relevant. Varna is not terribly relevant. But we are still left with different levels of segmentation. We saw that there were Brahmins, there were Smarthas, there were Vadamas, there were Varvesha Vadamas, caste group, caste, sub-caste, sub-sub-caste. All right? The question then arises, which is the level of segmentation at which caste enters the political process? Does it enter at the level of the caste group, or does it enter at the level of the caste, or does it enter at the level of the sub-caste, or does it enter at the level of the sub-sub-caste? At which level does caste enter into the political process? I mean, this is a question that one has to ask. The answer to that question is, of course, obvious, that there is no unique level at which caste enters into the political process. It depends on the level of the political process itself, at which level caste enters into the political process. That is, at a certain level of the political process, it is the sub-sub-caste which may be the relevant unit. At a different level, it is the whole group of castes that may be the relevant unit. Now let me give you an example which will illustrate this, and those of you who are familiar with the castes in Tamil Nadu will be able to understand this immediately. Others will be able to find other examples from areas with which they are familiar. I was doing fieldwork in Tamil Nadu in the Tanjore district in 1961-62. And right in the middle of my fieldwork, the 1962 elections, the general elections of 1962, were held. And I decided to follow a particular candidate in his travels through his constituency. And this man was a lawyer, and he was a friend of my Brahmin patron in Tillasthanam. My patron in Tillasthanam was a Brahmin Mirasdar, educated man. Characteristically, in that village, he did not have a single non-Brahmin friend, because most of the non-Brahmins in that village were tenants, landless laborers. But he had non-Brahmin friends outside of Tillasthanam. And one such was this man, who was a lawyer belonging to a caste, which is very important and influential, not very high up in the hierarchy, caste known as the Kallas. I'll write Kalla. All right? So he was a lawyer, and so I asked my friend, the Iyengar, to introduce me to this man, and he was very nice. And I said, do you mind if I come along with you when you go around the villages? He said, all right. So I went with him, not every day, but a couple of days. And I was interested specifically in one point, in trying to find out how he made his calculations regarding political support. Not that I expected that those calculations would turn out right, but what was the logic of his calculation? And because I wanted to find out how far caste entered into his calculation, and of course it did enter. So we were moving around, and I asked him, and then I got to know him well enough to be able to put my question to him quite frankly. And he said, yes, this is all a part of politics here, and you are here, you know this, and so on. And I said, now, what do you expect from those villages, and those villages, and those villages? And he said, you know, that village, I don't think I'll get much support there. My rival is a Vellala, and that's a Vellala village, so I don't think I'll get much support. That village, I'll get some support, not the one next door, but the other one, I'll get some support, and that one, and that one. He went on. And I took it all in. Then suddenly I realized that I knew one of the villages to which he was referring, and I also knew that it was not a Kalla village. It was in fact an Ahmadiyya village. And I pointed this out to him. I said, you know, you told me that you were depending on support in that village, that it's a Kalla village, but it's not a Kalla village. There are very few Kallas there. It's an Ahmadiyya village, the other one. And he laughed. He said, well, I can see that you've really begun to get into the system. But you know, he said, As far as this election is concerned, Kallas, Maravas and Ahmadiyyas, they are all together. They are not the same caste, but they are related castes. And as far as this election is concerned, we are all moving together. And in fact, there are three castes which are quite distinct castes. They do not intermarry with each other. They have quite distinct traditions and patterns, but they also have a myth of origin according to which they are all descended from the same mother. And they are in fact known as the Mulkulattur. People of the triple line. Okay? Triple line. Three. Mu means three. Three. So as far as that election is concerned, he said, we are together. And then he laughed. And he said, but you know, after the election is over, then our differences will become clear. And he said, you ought to know that even the Kallas themselves are not one homogeneous, undifferentiated unit. There are Kalla villages where they are subdivided, sharply subdivided into sub-castes. And when it comes to the politics of that particular village, it is one Kalla subcaste versus another Kalla subcaste. So in a sense, the segmentary system that I drew up for you has its effects also on the political process. Now, the point that I want to make is that it's not simply that the caste system is segmented such that you have caste group, then caste, then subcaste, then sub-subcaste, which can split apart or come together depending on context and situation, but the political process itself operates at different levels. It's not all national politics. You have national politics, you have state politics, you have district politics, you have block politics, you have village politics, you might even have politics of a particular hamlet of a village. So, there's a certain amount of matching between the segmentation in the political system or the territorial system and the segmentation in the caste system, but one must not take this too far, because over the years, caste leaders have learned how to make alliances right across the entire social space, so that a fairly low-down caste may in fact, for a particular purpose, enter into an alliance with another caste from which it is socially quite distant. And that alliance is for that particular period or for that particular occasion. So it's quite a complicated game, but the fact is that the idiom of caste loyalty, caste divisions, etc., enters again and again into this political process. It's made complicated by a large number of different factors, you see, because it's not as if the rivalries are clearly along caste lines, just as it is never the case that in American urban elections the rivalries are always clearly along ethnic group lines, because if the Congress Party recognizes that the Kallas are the important caste to back in this constituency, the opposition party may be caught on the wrong foot only the first time. Second time around, it will also select a candidate from that particular caste, so that then people will have to decide on additional considerations in choosing the one or the other candidate. The point is that you cannot win simply playing the caste card. Therefore, the point I'm making is that the caste card is important, and it's interesting that the caste card has been played and is being played consistently over the last 40 years. There's very little evidence of its dropping out. At the same time, all political figures realize that you cannot win by playing only the caste card. You have to play it with other cards as well. And this is the case, once again, this is typically the same pattern when you look at ethnic group politics in the United States. You can't win simply by playing the Italian card, because the other party will also put up an Italian candidate. And then you'll have to balance the different ethnic groups and balance, get into all kinds of alliances and so on and so forth. I think this has been one of the most interesting developments over the last 40 years, that the coming together, the coalition of castes, has not simply been along the traditional lines of segmentation of the kind that I showed to you yesterday, But the alliances over the years have been increasingly more sophisticated, if one puts it like that, have been governed more by specific political calculations such that groups have spanned large social distances in order to come together to form alliances. But these alliances, in such cases, are never very stable alliances. They shift from one electoral occasion to another occasion. So this is as far as units and levels of operation are concerned. Now, having come to all of this, let me propose a simple method for the study of a political system. Because after all, we are going to study caste and its involvement in politics. So how are we going to assess and examine the involvement of caste in the political system? Let me propose that in trying to understand any political system, not just a political system in India, but any political system anywhere, we have to deal with two kinds of problems. Firstly, what I call problems of distribution, basically the distribution of power, and secondly, what I call problems of process. And I think that if we keep these two sets of problems in mind, we can get a more systematic idea of how caste enters into the political process. Not only can we get a systematic idea of how caste enters into the political process, but we can apply the same scheme for examining, for instance, the politics of religious groups, or the politics of linguistic groups, or the politics of groups of any particular kind, ethnic groups, religious groups, linguistic groups, racial groups, and so on and so forth. Now, what do I mean by problems of distribution? By problems of distribution, I have the following kind of thing in mind. That no matter what you are studying as a part of the political system, you are concerned essentially with the manner in which power is distributed in that system. After all, what is the study of politics about? The study of politics is about the study of institutions through which power is distributed in society. That is basically what a political institution is. That is basically what a political structure is. It is a structure of power. All right? Now, there are many different kinds of structures of power. There are sort of local structures of power, regional structures of power, formal structures of power, informal structures of power, many different kinds of structures of power. But one characteristic of any territorial system, whether it is a village or a district or a state, is that it has a certain structure of power, a certain distribution of power. Now, an interesting feature of what has happened in India since independence is the tremendous proliferation and growth in these structures of power, particularly in the rural areas. All kinds of new structures of power have emerged in the rural areas. Panchayats with Panchayati Raj, parties, cooperatives, all kinds of organs in which power is distributed in a particular manner. Now, if that is the case, then the first question that we have to ask if we are interested in seeing the relationship between caste and politics is, how is this power distributed as between the different castes? If we take the various positions of power, let us say in a local structure, do we find that it is evenly distributed between all the different castes, or do we find that if we examine, let's say, all the panchayats in a particular district, do we find that most of the panchayats are in fact controlled by one particular caste or two particular castes? And you can ask the same kind of question in regard to any set of social divisions, whether based on caste or on religion or on language or on ethnicity. Now, of course, this is a sort of question which can be asked in regard to all these different structures of power, and so you have to be careful as to how you classify your structures of power in relation to which you are going to ask the question as to whether there is one caste or a couple of castes which are represented far in excess of their strength in the population as a whole in these various structures of power. All right? Now, you can do this in regard to any set of structures of power. If you take the system of Panchayati Raj, for instance, you can do that with the village panchayats, with the panchayat samitis, with the zilla parishads. You can take the political parties, break them down to their different units at different levels, the state unit, the district unit, the block unit, and find out who controls these political parties. Who are these political parties controlled by? Are the political parties controlled by people specifically of one particular caste or a couple of castes, or do we find all the castes more or less evenly represented in the control of these political parties? I think that one can do this in a fairly systematic way. Now, sometimes there is a kind of optical illusion in this, because you find, unless you make your comparisons very carefully, you may very well find that a particular caste has a very high representation in most of the structures of power. Whether you take the Zila Parishad, the Panchayat Union, or the village Panchayat, or whether you take the Congress Party or the DMK Party, you find that the Pareachis are in great strength in all of these organs. Now, it's very easy to infer from this, I believe mistakenly, that the Pareachis are a dominant caste. Because it might well turn out that they have 40% of the positions of power in these various organizations that you have examined, and they also have 40% of the total population of that particular district, in which case it wouldn't be quite valid to say that they have an excessive dominance in that. So you must have some sense of the numbers of these different castes in a particular area before you can really say whether you are in fact dealing with a caste which controls these organs of power in excess of what one would normally expect if things were evenly distributed. This is not always very easy to do. It is not always very easy to do, or at least it was not very easy to do at a time when I was playing this game, because caste breakdown for the population was not available. You see, the census doesn't give us the caste breakdown of the population after 1931. Yes?
I have very serious, that's why I am interrupting you, I have very serious disagreement with what you are saying, because I think this has been the problem in India, that we are trying to see something which is not there. If 40% of a caste happens to have power, it could be that they are worthwhile of having power, and therefore to summarize that there is one caste which is controlling power is very dangerous. The question to ask is, did the 40% of this caste population get together to put 40% of these people in power? Then caste has entered politics. Now,
if you give me 2 minutes, that's precisely what one moves into in this. You see, that gives you the starting point. You see, if 40% of them control the structures of power, or if 40% of the positions in the organs of power are controlled by a group which consists of only 2% of the population, it still is not decisive evidence that caste has entered consciously into the political process. It isn't decisive evidence. In order to get decisive evidence, you have to move here. But you won't mind if my suspicion is aroused when I see that 40% of all of this is controlled by a group which comprises only 2% of the population. You won't object to that. But I will agree that that is not decisive evidence that caste is being used as a factor in the political process. In fact, you know, I'm glad you raised this question, because in a way, this is the case in some parts of the country where some castes are very highly overrepresented in certain organs of power. For instance, in West Bengal, at least for the first 20 to 30 years since independence, certain castes were represented far in excess
of their strength in the population, in the assembly, in the Congress party, in the Communist party. Even though caste did not enter as a conscious factor in the mobilization of political support in that state. But you still are left with all kinds of questions that you have got. So the point that I want to make is that this is the first step, and it might leave you with questions to which you have to seek answers elsewhere. Now, I think that, you know, in some states you see this quite clearly, that there is a cornering of all kinds of political organs by one or two particular castes. All right? And I think that you can see this particularly over a period of time. And this becomes most conspicuous when you see changes in the caste composition of these organs of local government. And this kind of change has come about quite conspicuously in the southern states, certainly in Tamil Nadu, certainly in Karnataka. If you go back to the period immediately before independence, you'll get a certain kind of picture. And if you see the developments after independence, you see a systematic shift in the caste composition of most of the organs of power throughout the rural areas. I'm not saying that this has happened uniformly in all parts of the country, but this has happened in a very conspicuous way in Tamil Nadu and Karnataka. About that there is no doubt at all. How it has happened, whether it has come about, through some unconscious process without people deliberately organizing things in such a way that this is how it came about, are questions which we have to ask. But even if we can't find answers to those questions, we've got to ask those questions. Because how is it that this comes about through an unconscious mechanism? How is it that there are these systematic shifts in the caste composition of those who occupy strategic positions in the political structure, particularly in a society where the whole idiom of discourse, the whole language of discourse, keeps caste always in the forefront? I mean, it's simply not the case that it's only the sociologist or the political scientist who talks about these things. If you see how people organize support at election time, if you see the manner in which they set up groups and associations at the time of elections, then you will surely argue that it is worth finding out whether this has in fact been going on in a conscious way or not. Let me now come to this, problems of process. We have a kind of structure, and we see to what extent that structure is related to the structure of caste or the structure of communities or whatever it is. Then we come to the problem of process, which is basically concerned with the mobilization of support. You know, in every political process, there has to be some support for people to remain in power, to get into power. And if you want to displace those who are already in power, you have to mobilize support against them. This is routinized in democratic political systems by having elections every 5 years, every 4 years. This is essentially the way in which some people come into power, remain in power, or are displaced from power by other people through the mobilization of support. Now, the fact that this is institutionalized and routinized in the democratic system through the electoral process does not mean that this kind of thing does not exist in other political systems. It does exist in our political systems, but the mechanisms are different. Now, if you look just at the mobilization of support at election time, and not just throughout the period, the pattern is broadly the same, but you see it much more sharply at the time of elections. Then you see that support is not mobilized by an appeal to just one single factor. There are various kinds of appeals on the basis of which people seek to mobilize support, either to remain in power or to displace those who are in power and to take their places. There are various kinds of appeals that are made for mobilizing support. I will sort of give three kinds of factors. One is in return for material rewards. Real or promised, okay? You are familiar with this process. This process operates not only at the level of the national elections, it operates at the level of student union election, it operates at the level of every election. That if you vote for us, or if you help us to get those who are in power out of power, we will come into power and we will do this for you or do that for you. And pledges of material rewards may be given even before the elections are held. This is certainly one way in which support is sought to be mobilized. This is true in every political system. It may be done very crudely in some political systems, rather more subtly in other political systems. There's no democratic system in which people don't try to offer rewards or promise material rewards in return for the support of the electorate. Okay. But I don't think that that's the only factor at all. Because once again, here two can play at the same game. Second kind of appeal, which again, I mean, one mustn't discount the second kind of appeal, although it is wearing rather thin in our political system, is the appeal to some kind of universal values or ideas. We'll get you more equality, or we'll make the nation strong, or, you know, we'll protect democracy better. You know, these universal values, or general values, can range all the way from making India strong, self-reliant, respected, to the abolition of poverty, to the abolition of inequality, to a better deal for everybody, and so on and so forth. And again, one cannot discount altogether this factor as a factor in mobilizing support. But there's a third kind of factor which is used and has been used continuously in India particularly, and that is by an appeal to what I call primordial loyalties. You vote for us because we are your people. Blood is thicker than water. And that is where caste comes into the picture. The use of caste loyalties by appealing directly for support on the ground that we and we alone are people whom you can trust because we are of the same community. Maybe we are not Ahmadiyyas, but we are Kallas. And after all, what's the difference between Kallas and Ahmadiyyas? Maybe you are Shias and I am a Sunni, but what does it matter? We are all Muslims together, you see. So I think that this is the level at that even if one finds that in West Bengal, let's say, the organs of power show that some castes are highly overrepresented, nevertheless, one doesn't find the extensive use of this kind of idiom in the mobilization of political support, at least at the level of state elections. I'm not quite sure that one doesn't find any of this kind of thing at the level of village panchayat elections. But there's no doubt whatsoever that one finds an awful lot of this kind of thing not only at the level of village elections, but also at the level of state elections in a large number of different states in India. And that's the point that I was trying to make when I started here and moved on to this one. Now, how is all this done? What are the mechanisms through which all of this is done? Well, three or four different mechanisms through which this can be done. Mechanisms for mobilizing caste support. You know, a great deal of all of this is done at the grassroots level, at the village level, where a caste is also a community of kin. People of the same caste are related to each other extensively by ties of kinship and marriage. So this is one level at which support is mobilized by activizing the ties of kinship and marriage. One mustn't think of this as an effective or even a possible way of mobilizing support in a large city like Delhi or Calcutta or Bombay. But if you see how support is mobilized in elections in the rural areas, this is a very, very important factor. You get your son-in-law or you get your sister's husband's nephew to do a little bit of work, to go around in his village and to say that he is the candidate and he should be voted for because he's our man. A second way in which this is done is by making generalized appeals of the kind that blood is thicker than water. I told you yesterday a slogan which I used to see in South Arcot district, Vanyar vote to Anirku illai. The Vanyar vote is for nobody else. The Vanyar vote is only for the Vanyars. And I heard a beautiful slogan. I've forgotten which caste it was. Somebody pointed this out to me. And this was not in Tamil Nadu. This was in Rajasthan. The slogan was, in regard to a particular caste called caste X for this purpose, do not give your daughter or your vote to a non-X. And that's at once using an idiom and a language which goes straight to the heart of the caste system and extending it to a quite different area. Do not give your daughter or your vote to a non-X. So this kind of generalized appeal of caste sentiment is also used fairly extensively. Finally, caste associations come up. You see, formal organizations, which are caste associations, the Padayachis, who are now on the warpath, are not on the warpath for the first time. I mean, the Tamil Nadu Toilers Party and the Commonweal Party, in the 51-52 elections, they started as caste associations of the Padayachis and transformed themselves into political parties and fought the elections and won a number of seats and then worked out a compromise with the Congress Party and dissolved. There are some caste associations which remain as a permanent feature of the scene, like the SNDP. SNDP is a very, very important factor in Kerala politics, despite the fact that Kerala politics has been dominated by left ideology for a very, very long time. SNDP is the caste association of, of a low-level caste of toddy tappers, numerically very large and very important in Kerala politics. So it's not simply a question of working it out on the basis of statistics, but seeing how the SNDP has grown and what role it plays in not only in elections, but also in ministry-making in states like Kerala. The Nair Service Society is an extremely important association which has played an extremely important part in Kerala politics. But not all caste associations have been of that kind. Many caste associations mushroom at the time of the elections and then disappear or hibernate for 4 or 5 years and come back into existence at the time of elections. So these are the various ways in which caste enters and continues to enter into the political process through elections, during election times and in between election times also. Some caste associations play an extremely important part in the day-to-day running of the political process. There are some very powerful caste associations which do this, and some of them then develop an interest in promoting the interests of their caste, not only at the time of elections, but in a variety of other ways as well, by arguing, for instance, that since we have been badly treated in the past, some reparation should be made to us. We are socially disadvantaged, we are socially disprivileged, and we have been badly treated for generations and for centuries, and some reparation should be done to us socially. And that is how caste politics acquires a specific form of the politics of backwardness. So the politics of backwardness is not simply a measure following from the constitutional commitment to creating greater equality between the different castes and communities, but the politics of backwardness is met halfway by the presence of these caste associations, which then demand that they should have not only their voices heard in the political process, but they should also get their fair share of whatever there is for the government to distribute by way of education and employment. I think, sure. Mrs. Singh, I think that there's just one point that I would like to add. I mean, I think that what you're saying is quite true. But there's just one point that I'd like to add, Mrs. Singh.
that there is a history of all of this, and there is a pattern of development in all of this. In Bihar, the politics of backwardness is relatively recent as compared to Tamil Nadu and Karnataka. So that the pattern that you see in Bihar in the 80s may not be exactly the same as the pattern that you see in Tamil Nadu in the 80s. I don't think that in Tamil Nadu...
I'm telling you, for example, the members of parliament, their approach, you know, which they take to an issue.
Yes.
An issue, for instance, which is raised, you know, something in the name of uplift.
Yes.
Take an example. Normally, you see, if they hear from a region, you can understand that because, you know, the pace of development has been lower than...
I'm talking about the pace of economic development. I was talking about the experience of caste politics, particularly the politics of backwardness. You see, reservation, apart from the
But then, you see, what I was trying to say, that, you know, when you mention that this factor which is now entering into politics, and now the play of the backward politics, you know, just at that stage, I said it would be morally fair to point out that, you know, the backward politics, if it remains confined to the backward playing the politics,
yes. Yes.
There's somebody else, you know, who is doing the backplay.
No, but in two senses, Mrs. I think we mustn't obscure this fact, that this somebody else is a somebody else in two different senses. One is, you might say, that let's take a state like Bihar, you have the backward class, you have the scheduled tribes, the scheduled castes, and then the backward castes like Kurmis, Koeris, Ahirs, etc., etc. And this somebody else may then be Brahmins and castes, who are not going to gain from the politics of backwardness, but who nevertheless do this in pursuit of a different political gain. They have a different kind of political interest, and they are unscrupulous enough to promote this in order to promote their other political... That may be one thing. The somebody else may also be not a member of a forward caste, but very affluent, successful families belonging to the backward castes, and therefore not really requiring for themselves or for their families the benefits and advantages of reservation, but being the ones who benefit and gain most by this kind of thing. So when one is saying that the people who benefit by the politics of backwardness are not the really backward people, when one says, and this is something that is often said, that there is the politics of backwardness, and this politics of backwardness continues because some people benefit by it. And then one goes on further to say that those people who benefit by it are not really the ones who are truly backward. I think it has to be pointed out that one means this in two different senses. One means by this that the benefits go to the leaders of these backward castes who are themselves not backward. Or one can also mean, as you seem to be saying, that the benefits might go to people who don't belong to backward castes at all. And there's a different kind of political gain which leads the benefits, or a very different kind of benefit, to move out of the backward community itself. But I'm not very sure that I would agree with that for...
I wish it was the economic and social backwardness that really was the criteria to be accepted by the nation. Unfortunately, it's not. Unfortunately, I think that the official acceptance and almost recognition of the fact that it is based on community.
We would not be talking about the politics of backwardness. That would be a different kind of politics altogether. So therefore, I think that we have to keep in mind the fact that if there is a miscarriage of the scheme for providing special benefits to the really disprivileged, this is because those special benefits which are intended for the really disprivileged are cornered by the leaders of their communities who are themselves not disprivileged at all. This is the argument, isn't it?
Actually, what you are not going to give, you are only promising. Ultimately,
but you
just only promise.
Yeah, but
and it's only to come to the power. Of course, then you come.
No, you give some. No, you give some. No, that it won't happen. No. There, I don't think that's true. You give some. I mean, you do give some. But whether, you know, it's not that you don't give anything at all. Look, if you look at education and employment, you will find that that there has been a considerable redistribution, at least in terms of caste, in education and employment, certainly in Tamil Nadu, certainly in Karnataka. But of course, one might ask the question, that despite all this redistribution of education and employment, what proportion of Indian society goes to the medical colleges and the engineering colleges and gets employment in the organized sector? But if you confine yourself to higher education and to employment in the organized sector, particularly in the public sector, there has certainly been a certain amount of redistribution.
Well, explain the two chief ministers of Karnataka being Brahmins, even though it's completely the Brahmins are a minority.
Sure, it can explain that. Mr. Rao, look at it like this. Suppose you are an Okaliga member, and the Okaligas are a very strong caste, and a very powerful caste, and they've had Chief Hanumantaya was a great Okaliga chief minister, and he is a Lingayat, and the Lingayats are also very powerful, and you know, we've had many Nijalingappa and so on and so forth, okay? And you are locked in conflict, and there is a deadlock. A compromise candidate may in fact come in from a group which is held in suspicion neither by him nor by you. And that happens very often, you see. So I won't say that Mr. Hegde's being a chief, but the manner in which Mr. Hegde operated is very interesting. You see, Mr. Hegde did not operate, as far as this part was concerned, Mr. Hegde did not operate in a manner which would have caused serious disaffection among either Okaligas or Lingayats. In fact, if I had been an Okaliga, I would have gone in for Mr. Hegde, you see. That's a safer bet. Because if I had been an Okaliga, I would have found an outside candidate a safer bet rather than the possibility of a Lingayat coming in on an evenly balanced electoral ticket. So there's nothing very surprising about that.
No, to come back to the point that you're saying, what is happening in Tamil Nadu is somewhat different from what Mr. Singh is happening elsewhere. Because in Tamil Nadu, the groups which have favored the...
Of course, yes. But you see, Ms. Muthuraman, I mean, the Karnataka has gone much further than Tamil Nadu. Karnataka has gone to the extent where everybody is now backward, you see. 92% of the population is categorized as backward. Are you gone?
State is right at the back.
92% of the population is backward.
State will be declared as a backward in India. And have a benefit of backward state.
And that is politics coming to the governmental operations like secretary and these people who are there in the secret and Vidhan Sabha and Parliament. How does it affect the government employees and the public, etc.? We are going to the SR for everything.
I beg your pardon? Going to the?
Yes, sir. We have to apply for everything and everything of the political leaders.
Yes, well, I mean, you know, everything will function more or less in the way in which a village panchayat is supposed to function. You see, a village is made up of a number of castes, and it is felt that it is only right that each caste should have some voice in matters that concern it. But the only thing is that it's impossible to run a modern organization on that principle, and it seems that in some states, This has now become so deeply entrenched that it's very difficult to see how it can be reversed. Become very, very deeply entrenched in some states. Shall we have a cup of tea and then come back?